Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to today's podcast with me, Patricia Devlin. Today's guest is a former undercover police officer turned crime author. Stephen Bentley now spends his time writing about crime instead of investigating it. You're very welcome, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. Pleasure to meet you, Les.
We'll be mostly talking about your new book, which will be of huge interest to people, not only in Northern Ireland, but further afield, those who are interested into the workings of undercover police and also the workings of criminal gangs. And your book, Operation George, which I have here, I have a lovely copy, and I've read it, and it's about how undercover police in the UK took down LVF terrorist Jim Fulton. And it's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating insight into how police took the time to really make sure they had the evidence to have Jim Fulton, who was a very dangerous individual, jailed. Before we start on Operation George, we will speak about your background, Stephen. And I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. You were involved in an operation called Operation Julie in the 1970s, and that involved more than 800 police officers from 11 forces. It smashed two LSD production and distribution centres in Wales, and it was one of the biggest undercover policing operations at that time.
Yes, it was. It's still billed as the UK's biggest drugs bust, and it never seems to go away. Although it happened in the 1970s, it still crops up in my life. I mean, it was a big part of my life, but it still crops up. I'll give you an example, Patricia. Only recently, a guy that runs a podcast called Talking with the Hippies, He contacted me, and he'd read my book, the Operation Julie book, and he was quite fascinated by it. And he had some reservations about talking to a former undercover cop, but we got on fine, and in the end he said, well, you're actually quite a nice guy. You don't think of you as an undercover cop anymore. But yeah, that was my first venture into writing books, and it's done very well. In fact, it's now optioned for an 8-part TV series, and hopefully we can get some good news about a broadcaster picking it up. It's actually in development right now. There's a script and all the rest of it. So hopefully good news sometime this year.
That's brilliant news, and it will be an excellent TV drama or even a film. Stephen, I'm going to show people you undercover during Operation Julie.
That is indeed me, and if anybody reads the book, the Operation Julie book, they'll realise that that is the day when I was absolutely, totally stoned, off my head completely. Not just stoned through whatever it was I was smoking, but I'd had a lot of drink that day as well. That was the day we moved a piano for some hippie guy, and I fell out of the van as we were moving it, and ended up in a field next to a bull. Yeah, that was, there were great days. There were, yeah, that's me, a lot more hair and et cetera, et cetera. Much younger.
You looked the part. So can you tell me how you became involved? You know, when did you join the police, Stephen, and how quickly did you move from ordinary policing to undercover policing?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right, I joined the police way back now in 1966. Yeah, 1966. And I did my 2 years probation like most coppers. And that was mandatory. And I was lucky, really, even during my first 2 years as a uniform copper in my probationary period. You know, I'd shown an aptitude for crime and catching criminals. And so at the tender age of 21, I was on CID. And that was on Merseyside, a place called Kirby near Liverpool. And I was on CID at Kirby, and then went on to the Task Force CID in Lancashire, where we were investigating murders and other serious crimes. We were kind of drafted in to help the local CID. And so I spent in total, it was 14 years on CID in total. And then I transferred from Merseyside to Hampshire, and that's when I got drafted into Operation Julie. And I must correct you on one thing, that yeah, there were 800 police officers involved, but they were involved in the bus at the end of Operation Julie. There were actually 25 of us on the undercover police team, the Operation Julie undercover police team, which lasted for 2 years. The inquiries lasted for 2 years. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell. And then I don't know, as you already know, because you've already done research. Once I left the police force, then I was doing various jobs, and eventually trained got a law degree, and I eventually trained as a barrister and practiced criminal law as a barrister in London and the provinces in England. For another 14-year period, funnily enough, so almost 30 years in law enforcement, one way or another.
Wow.
So, yeah, quite a varied career.
I
turned to writing books.
what a life. And what did you enjoy more, the undercover police work, or did you enjoy the barrister role more?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a tough one to answer. I think I enjoyed both, because it was what I was doing at that particular time, and I enjoyed them. It's very difficult to compare one to another, because they're very different lives, very different roles, completely. Very difficult question to ask. But what I would say, in an attempt to give you a very straight answer, is that my role as an undercover police officer, where I adopted a completely different, a false identity and infiltrated, mixed with these drug dealers. I got very close to one of the drug dealers in particular, a character called Smiles, which I mentioned in the book. And, you know, I got very, very close to him, and it affected me. You know, at one time I was even very tempted to sort of spill the beans to him. You know, that's how close I'd become to him. I didn't. That's how close I'd become to him. And so, you know, from a personal point of view, it had personal, there was an aftermath, you know, there were personal ramifications for me adopting this dual personality, this dual role. So that part I didn't enjoy. The part I did enjoy, because I was a young man, I was 29, 30 at the time, was the adrenaline kick, you know, the adrenaline rush. And obviously, you know, I enjoyed that. And one of my heroes from films and books, I read the book and saw the movie about three times, was Frank Serpico, you know, in the movie, in the book called Serpico, the New York cop. You know, you know, before I ever became an undercover police officer, I thought, oh, Frank Serpico, you know, he was one of my heroes. So it was all that adrenaline rush, which was great at the time, but it did have a personal cost to me, you know, which was instrumental in me leaving the police force in 1980. And then I was drifting around doing other various jobs, sales, driving lorries, driving trucks for almost 10 years until I went back to school and got a law degree and then qualified as a barrister. So, yeah, quite a varied background.
Very, very varied, Stephen. I think a lot of people would like to know what, you know, did you have a family when you began undercover police work? Because, I mean, if you have a family, and I don't know if you have children or if you had children or you know undercover police officers who do have children, how on earth would you balance that with a double life? How would you, you know, when would you get to see them? Is it hard keeping up this other identity? Those little things always fascinated me about how hard it must be to go undercover.
That part of it was very difficult. Yes, I did have a family, and it was very difficult because I was away from them for long periods of time, and my appearance changed dramatically. You know, you showed the picture of me when I was undercover as a hippie type character, and it wasn't just my appearance that changed because of the nature of the job. I think my demeanor changed as well. So, I mean, it got to a stage where, to be quite frank, you know, I went home for a couple of days, 3 days, to get away from the scene where I was working. But I was glad to get out again, you know, to get back to the scene, to get back to where I was deployed. And because, you know, my life was, personal life was in turmoil, really. So it's very, very difficult, you know. And I must stress the other book, which deals with William James Fulton, who you've already mentioned, was co-written with another former undercover officer using the pseudonym Mark Dickens. And, you know, I've spoken to Mark, obviously, on many, many occasions when we were writing the book in particular. I know from him as well that the, you know, the stress on home life and being away from your home and your family is very difficult to deal with. But, you know, it's the job that you do, and you've just got to get on and do it, you know.
And you also had to take drugs, Stephen, because you were infiltrating a drugs gang and you had to make it look like you were one of them. So, I mean, how did you feel about that?
I did, and you know, it's when you say I had to take drugs, nobody forced me to, but I, you know, I agree with what you say. I was mixing with drug dealers and people who were heavy users of drugs, mainly cannabis. Fortunately, a lot of them also used acid, LSD a lot. But fortunately, in the drug world, nobody forces you to take LSD, and I never ever took it, so I never experienced it and never wanted to. But cannabis, smoking cannabis, not just in a joint, but using pipes, bongs, you know, and taking really big doses of cannabis in one go, so much so that it makes you hallucinate. You know, that was part of my undercover life, and I just had to get used to it. And then another stage came along where people were involved with cocaine, and cocaine was laid out on the glass table in front of me. I was invited to take it, you know, to snort it. I'm going, well, hell, what you do, you know? You know, I'm supposed to be one of them. I'm supposed to be kind of a drug dealer and posing as a drug dealer and all the rest of it. So, you know, I had to use it. And, you know, it makes me laugh that in the modern era, the College of Policing in England now say that an undercover officer under no circumstances must use drugs, you know, because, and if they do, they could be subjected to A, disciplinary proceedings, and B, possibly criminal proceedings. Well, I personally think that's a nonsense, because I can't see how you can mix with a certain type of person who is using drugs and not get away with partaking, with going along with the whole scenario. But that's my view, and perhaps I'm wrong, but Nobody will change my point of view on that.
I would find it hard to believe that anybody can infiltrate these gangs and, I mean, not take drugs. That's what they do. They're going to be suspicious of anybody who's coming in. Was your cover almost blown at any stage? Did you feel, you know, they may have suspected that you were undercover at any point?
Many a time the character smiles that we were free to get close to, and we did get close to. I mean, my undercover partner, Eric, ended up babysitting for Smiles one night, so that was that's an indication of, you know, how much Smiles and his wife trusted us or trusted Eric to babysit for them. While Smiles, his wife, and a few others, we went out for a meal, a Chinese meal, a few miles away. And Smiles was a very suspicious character. You know, he was although he lived in Wales, in a very rural part of Wales where we were also living, you know, his drug dealing operation extended into London, Birmingham, and in fact he was involved in, you know, through other people. It was his consignments were being shipped to places like Australia as well, so he was in it big time. And you know, because it was a rural community, any strangers that came into that community, and that included Eric and I when we first drove in there and went to live there, he treated them with suspicion. And on one occasion, we gave him a lift in our van. We had an old battered transit van. And he came out with it, and he just said, "Hey, guys, what's the scam? You know, you're cops, aren't you? You know?" So, you know, we just had to laugh it off. Well, that was Smiles. You know, he lived by his wits, and he did challenge us on that particular occasion. And undoubtedly, he was suspicious of us for a long time. But there were two particular incidents that changed his mind. Number one, we were having a heavy drinking session one night, and the landlord of the pub had called Chime, but we carried on drinking, and the local police officer came in uniform, and in a rather nasty way, sort of ordered us to get out there, you know. So I'm drunk and I'm playing the part, so I use a lot of bad language, and I tell him to stick his truncheon in a part of his body that the sun can't reach. So we're Smiles at this particular time, and another guy, and the other guy lived locally. So, you know, this copper, he comes back, and I'm still giving him grief, and we run off, and he runs after us, the copper runs after us, and we hide in this local guy's place until the copper disappears. Smiles turns around to me, and he nicknamed me Cop Killer after that particular episode, and I think that helped persuade him that I wasn't a cop, or helped persuade him to become less suspicious. And then there was another incident where we were up in Liverpool, and we met this Canadian gangster. We were offered to get involved in a deal involving substantial quantities of cocaine. And I'm talking about many, many kilos weight-wise of cocaine. And Smiles got to hear about that. So towards the end of our time infiltrating him and the community, Smiles actually came to me and what was trying to score by cocaine from me. So I think that was a measure of, in the end, that we successfully persuaded him that we weren't cops, you know. So, yeah.
What was your backstory, Stephen?
Backstory was that Eric and I were looking for Eric's brother, who got into a minor scrape with some minor drugs charge in England, and he disappeared. He'd absconded whilst on bail, and he was supposed to be living with hippies in Wales. And that explained our presence in that particular part of Wales, that we were looking for Eric's brother. And we explained our odd disappearances by the fact that we said that we dealt in second-hand cars, buying and selling cars. We bought the cars at auction in Southampton and you know, sold them all over the place with, like, for cash, and it was all nudge and a wink that we, you know, we weren't averse to doing a little bit of dealing, and, you know, we occasionally showed a little bit of cannabis that, you know, that we borrowed from the drug, from the police drugstore, and this, that, and the other. And then Eric was a dab hand. I was a city boy, you know, raised in Liverpool. And Eric was a country boy raised in Gloucester. Eric was a dab hand with a chainsaw. So we also offered to lock trees and do this, that, and the other. Plus we had the van, so we did the odd removal, like a piano that we moved one day for one hippie, from one hippie's house to another. So, you know, that was kind of our backstory, how we assimilated ourselves into the community.
Wow, yeah, and you did it very well. I'm reading here that over 1 million LSD tabs were seized, and enough crystal to make 6.5 million more because of your work. And after trial, 15 defendants were given jail terms, adding up to over 120 years.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that is correct. Yeah, including the guy that I befriended, this Smiles character I keep mentioning, he got 8 years. And so the sentences range from the people at the top who were the chemists, they were manufacturing it, and the people in charge, they got 13 years. Right down to, I think, 2 years was the minimum sentence for kind of lesser dealers in the distribution network.
And Smiles, you did have a conversation with him, a very short one, after your cover was revealed or blown. Said, do you know hard feelings?
He did. That was in the cells after he'd been arrested, and I got so close to him, I particularly wanted to have a word with him. I was very tentative. I was worried, actually, how he'd react. But I said to my boss at the time, I said, look, I've really got to go and speak to him, you know, just get it off my chest. So I went in to see him in the cell. And at first, you know, I cleaned up a bit by then. You know, I still had the beard and the hair was fairly long, but I cleaned up a lot. And at first he looked at me, and it was almost, I could almost see what he was thinking, you know, what's this guy involved in cocaine, the cocaine dealer, doing in a cell with me? He's nothing to do with LSD. And then the penny dropped, he realized it was me, and we hugged each other, like, you know, a great big man hug, and he said to me, he said, you know, no hard feelings. And and I'm not being melodramatic, but my eyes actually teared up. You know, because I did actually like the guy immensely. You know, he wasn't a bad guy or a violent guy. And, you know, in a different life, a different world, I'm sure that we could have been the best of friends. I'm sure of that. So, yeah.
Do you ever think about him now, Stephen?
Occasionally. Yeah, obviously something like this crops up and I think about him, but most of the time, the answer is no, I don't. I mean, it's kind of there as a distant memory, you know, because it was distant, you know, it's a long time ago. You know, I know the people that are behind the trying to get the TV series done, they've got this idea that it would be great that once it gets aired, you know, that, you know, it would be great to get the two of us together in the same pub and have a beer or something, you know. So, you know, maybe that'll happen. I don't know.
Yeah, wow. That would be an interesting conversation. And you've spoken before, Stephen, about undercover policing, and you believe the reputation has been damaged, particularly because of Mark Kennedy, the undercover policing officer, who... Yeah. I mean, you said his actions were absolutely disgusting.
Yes, they were. There's no place for that type of undercover policing activity in an area that is political and it's not to do with criminal activities. I mean, those people, it was a political movement. They were political activists. Some of the people that Mark Kennedy and a few others infiltrated, not only infiltrated, but I mean, my word, I mean, as we all know, it's public knowledge now, that, you know, he actually fathered children by some of the women activists, you know, I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. There's no place for it in undercover policing, and yes, it has got undercover policing a bad reputation, and that's why to be quite frank, I'm delighted that the opportunity came along to co-write this Operation George book with Mark Dickens, because it puts the whole undercover policing operational sphere into a different context completely. You know, that's what proper undercover policing is about. It's about catching and detecting and infiltrating organized crime gangs, whether they be paramilitary terrorists and murderers, or whether they be big drug dealers, violent drug dealers, or, you know, gun runners, people traffickers, terrorists of any kind of description, you know, not just loyalists, but I'm thinking about in the modern world, you know, with the whole thing that's going on with jihad and all the rest of it. You know, it's that's the place for proper, as I call it, proper undercover policing and how it should operate.
Brilliant, Stephen. So you can still buy Stephen's book on Operation Julie. Here it is here.
You can indeed. The ebook version, the Kindle version, looks slightly different than that. It's got a slightly new cover, but that's the print version. So yeah. Thanks. Brilliant. Thanks for the mention.
No problem. And moving on to your new book, which is Operation George. And for anybody who doesn't know, it touches upon the actions of an LVF gang. It focuses on Jim Fulton's arrest. He was an LVF terrorist. He's now locked up for 25 years in McGabbery Prison in Northern Ireland. And this book not only takes us inside that policing operation, and I have to just get the dates right, 1999 to 2001. Is that right, Stephen?
Yeah, that's correct. That's when the operation ran, yes, as you know, Rosemary Nelson was murdered in 1999.
And that's what I was just about to say. Your book doesn't only take us inside the policing operation. It takes us back a bit to what was happening in Northern Ireland and the reasons why Jim Fulton was of interest. So yes, for anyone who doesn't know, the Loyalist Volunteer Force, or LVF, is a Ulster paramilitary group in Northern Ireland formed by terror leader Billy Wright, who was murdered in the Mays Prison in 1997. William James Fulton, who's known as Jim, was one of these members. He's now aged 53 and is serving a life sentence in McGabbery Prison. Also in the book is the story of Muriel Gibson, a grandmother who was convicted of destroying evidence in relation to the 1998 LVF murder of Adrian Lamph. Tell me about Operation George and how, Stephen, you ended up writing this book with one of the undercover officers who was actually involved.
Yeah, that's a great linking question, because this is where we link in Operation Julie and Operation George, because through another podcast, it's actually a four-part series on Operation Julie. Can I mention the name of the podcast?
Of course you can.
True Crime Investigators UK. It's a four-part podcast. They've done other podcasts too, but four-part podcast on Operation Julie. And Mark Dickens was listening to that podcast, and through various means, through social media, he made contact with me, because it was quite clear that after we'd had an initial chat that he was interested in somebody helping him write a book about Operation George, his experiences on Operation George. So that's how it came into being. And when we first chatted, rather discreetly and secretly through encrypted messages and all the rest of it, it was quite clear that the story he had to tell was fascinating, the story of Operation George. At that stage, that's when I started researching it. To be quite frank, I'd never heard of it before. I'd obviously heard of the LVF. I'd never heard of Jimmy Fulton as a character mentioned, or Muriel Gibson. I was aware of the LVF and various other factors. I think I'd vaguely heard of Billy Wright. But I started researching Operation George, and that, of course, led me to the Rosemary Nelson murder inquiry, and that's how Operation George got started in the immediate aftermath. Yes, she is, rest in peace, and that's how it got started after Rosemary Nelson was murdered with the car bomb. Terrible. That was her BMW that was blown up with her inside of it. Shocking. But those pictures kind of throw me because, you know, one can only think about the horrors of that particular murder and then what brought about Operation George. But to put it in a nutshell, for anybody who doesn't know, to put it into a nutshell, there was undoubtedly a lot of political pressure at that time in Northern Ireland. The then chief constable of what was then known as the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, a man called Ronnie Flanagan, was undoubtedly put under a lot of political pressure because, you know, there was this lobby in the United States that was up in arms about congressmen. You know, questions were being asked in Congress about, prior to Rosemary Nelson's murder, about the way she was treated on the Dunkree marches, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this political pressure was so much so, the FBI were called into to liaise with the RUC, and at a very early stage, I think the guy's name was John Guido, an FBI special agent, and he suggested that they bring somebody in from the mainland, from England, to head up the inquiry into the murder of Rosemary Nelson, and that man was in fact Colin Ports, who was then the Deputy Chief Constable of Norfolk. Well, he was a career detective. I say was because he's no longer a serving police officer. But he was a career detective. You name it, he'd experienced it in terms of crime investigation. And he set up a murder investigation team looking into Rosemary Nelson's murder in Belfast. And it soon became clear that Jim Poulsen was an early suspect, along with his brother, Mark Swinger Poulsen. They were early suspects in the Rosemary Nelson murder. And I must stress at this stage, there's never been any evidence to link Jim Poulsen in particular to that murder of Rosemary Nelson. I must stress that. But it became clear that Jim Poulter had disappeared. In fact, he'd gone to California. And rather stupidly, he'd got arrested in California. I say stupidly because there was an incident where it's alleged that Tanya, Jim Poulter's wife, had discharged some firearms in California, a place called Murrieta that I happen to know quite well, funnily enough. Anyway, they were arrested. Jim Poulsen and his wife were arrested on firearms charges, drugs charges, and immigration charges. And him being an early suspect in the Rosemary Nelson inquiry, obviously, I'm convinced it was Colin Port and John Guido from the FBI that were behind this. They thought, well, how can we get this guy back and try and set up an operation to try and find out what Jim Poulsen knows, if anything, about the murder of Rosemary Nelson. So what they did, in collaboration with the FBI, Jim Poulsen was deported, and he arrived back at Heathrow. And it was quite clear to Colin Port and Guido, and no doubt others, senior command in the RUC, that running an undercover operation in Belfast or Lurgan, anywhere in Northern Ireland, was totally out of the question for a number of reasons. The RUC, I'm going to say this politely, had its problems. And people who know Northern Ireland a lot better than I do and know the history will understand that that is code for, you know, there were certain elements of the RUC that were suspected of having links with loyalist paramilitary organizations and so on and so forth. So an undercover operation was never, ever going to work in Northern Ireland. So what happened was the team, the Operation George team, as it soon became known, they found out that Muriel Gibson had also disappeared from Northern Ireland. And she was living in a B&B, a bed and breakfast, in Plymouth, Devon, England. So the idea was, and it was executed, that somehow they would have to get to Muriel Gibson to persuade Jim Poulton to come over to England. And if he did come over to England, that's where they could set the trap, the sting, the undercover operation. And that is basically what happened, that Muriel Gibson was, when I say infiltrated, what I mean is that the undercover officers, including a female undercover officer called Liz, that she was sent to Plymouth to get to know Muriel, and she did. And there were also another two undercover officers set up in Camborne in Cornwall. So that Liz got chatting away, got friendly with Muriel Gibson, and Liz introduced a character called Neil, who was actually also another undercover officer. And basically the story was that Neil was looking for a driver, and Liz kind of dropped hints that, you know, Neil wasn't a straight-up businessman. He was a bit shady, a bit dodgy, you know. And anyway, long story is, Liz is in contact with Jim Poulton, and she persuades him to turn up in Plymouth because there's a possibility of this, a job driving for this Neil character, Liz's friend. I don't think, reading between the lines, I don't think Jim Poulton took too much persuading, because I think he knew life was difficult for him back in the province at that particular time, after he'd come back from the United States, because there was all sorts of stuff going on. And I think that he felt his life was genuinely threatened, which it probably was. Plus, the police, when he arrived at Heathrow, the special branch, as they had to do by law, it's called an Osman warning, because there was some intelligence that Jim Poulton's life was in danger and had been threats. Jim Poulton was given an Osman warning. In other words, you know, you better watch your step, because we've received intelligence that your life has been threatened. So I think Jim Poulton didn't need an awful lot of persuading to get out of the province again, but instead of going back to the United States, which would have been problematic for him, seeing he'd just been deported, he ended up in Plymouth with Muriel Gibson. Then he meets Neil. Neil tests him as a driver, takes him on as a driver, and then over a period of time, the kind of sucking Jim into this network, this rabbit hole, as I call it in the book, like a, you know, Lewis Carroll type rabbit hole, where Jim ends up thinking that he's working for an organized crime group with Neil at the head. You know, because they're planning these scams all over England, you know, hijacking lorry loads of spirits, lorry loads of tobacco, cigarettes. They even planned a cash in transit robbery, but soon dropped that because they realized that at some stage maybe firearms would get involved, and Jim Poulton and firearms was a no-no. Those two don't mix at all. And I think my favourite story of all, I really enjoyed writing the chapter in the book, was the work of art, the purported stolen Lowry, where they actually managed to involve undercover counterparts from Belgium as a prospective buyer of the stolen Lowry. And another Belgian undercover officer was the tester. He was testing the provenance of the stolen painting. And they all did this deal in a hotel in somewhere in Middle England somewhere. Jim Fulton's thriving on this because he, at one particular point, he was given the job of patting down these guys, these Belgian guys, who were supposed to be buying a stolen work of art. He was given the job of patting them down to see if they had any guns. And I can't do the accent, but I can imagine him turning around to the other undercover officers saying, "Oh, great, this is right down my street, you know, guns." You know, so it was just an amazing, amazing story, you know, and Mark was telling me the stories, and, you know, and my job was to, with all the greatest respect to Mark, and I'm sure he doesn't mind me saying this, my job was to turn his stories into proper English.
Yeah, and to actually what can be read, and I know, yeah, what's great about your book, actually, I know we're kind of going off topic here, is the start of the book where you've got all the different slang words, undercover cop slang words, all done, yeah, and described. It's like a little dictionary, which I found it was really interesting. And one of the most interesting quotes in the book, and you've obviously written it and talked to Mark about this, was that just like Jim Carrey's character in The Truman Show, Fulton's environment had been controlled and his life manipulated. He believed he'd been living cheek by jowl in the company of gangsters in Plymouth. In fact, he'd been living in a bubble not of his own creation, which I thought was, I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Not a clue. Not a clue.
Yeah, it's he didn't have a clue, and that's exactly, I think that encapsulates what the whole undercover sting was about. And actually listening to you reading those words back, I must give myself a pat on the back for writing them.
It's very good, yeah, honestly, and I mean it. I can see a lot of people taking a huge interest in this book, and they already have, Stephen. I mean, it's not every day that you get to read about not only somebody like Jim Fulton being taken down and then say details, but I mean, this, and you've described this in the book, it was the most audacious undercover sting in the world.
I think so. There's stuff gone on over the years, and you think back to the States in particular, you think back to Donny Brasco and all the rest of it. But I think this particular undercover sting, this undercover operation, I think it's right up there with anything that's ever happened in the world. I really do. It's quite an amazing story, and I feel proud and I feel privileged to be part of, you know, writing the story. I just thoroughly enjoyed. I love writing the book, and I loved all the toing and froing between Mark and I when we were collaborating on the writing process. It was just brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And at the same time, it was also, it was sad as well. You know, I do say early on in the book, very early on, maybe in the first chapter, that as the authors, that we do have the utmost sympathy and empathy with all the victims of all the terrible crimes that have been perpetrated in Northern Ireland, for want of a better phrase, it's one that everybody knows it by. I'm going to use the phrase the Troubles. It's a tragic shame. It really is. And as I've said to you before in previous conversation, private conversations, it's on a personal note, I find it very sad, because I find the people in Northern Ireland, the ones I've met, very, very friendly, very hospitable people. I just love the place, you know, and it's kind of, it brings home, really rams home the sadness of it all to me as an individual, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, Stephen. And we're all lovely people. We've been through a lot. And absolutely. I mean, I think you touched upon issues with policing and things here. We're still living that legacy. There are still issues. We still have paramilitaries over 20 years after the Good Friday Agreement. We're in a different place now, thank goodness. I thought it was a very touching paragraph that you wrote on the last exchange Rosemary Nelson had with her friend just before she was brutally murdered. It was very touching, and I'm sure anybody reading it will also find it very touching. And it was actually just Rosemary's anniversary on the 15th of March. She was murdered in 1999. And, I mean, no one's ever been convicted over a murder. Hopefully someday somebody will, but at present not yet.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And thanks very much once again for your kind words and you know, it's almost, it's impossible to you know, feel what her husband and what her children must have been through since that that terrible incident. It's just unimaginable for me. Unimaginable. I just can't think as to what it must have been like.
The sectarianism that Jim Fulton displayed must have shocked officers. I mean, he's quoted in the book as saying to one officer, they've got to shoot a Catholic about once a week, and that's why they broke away. And he's referring to the LVF. That's why the LVF broke away from the UVF, because they weren't killing enough Catholics.
It is shocking, and the officers must have found it shocking, not only the officers that it was actually relayed to, you know, that were in the presence of Jim Fulton, but the, you know, the people in the background, the listeners, in places where, secret places where they were listening to the tapes, the transcribers, you know, civilian staff. They must have all been shocked to hear such, you know, and I describe it in the book as genocide, and it is genocide. There's no getting away from it. You know, it's just a shocking statement to come out with. And it shocked me, and I must say this again on a personal note, having been brought up in Liverpool, I was no stranger to sectarian problems. You know, July 12th.
Yeah,
we had the 12th of July marches in Liverpool.
Really? I didn't even realise that.
Like through Everton Brow, and then at the end of the march, you know, they used to jump on a train at Exchange Station, Liverpool, and get the train up to Southport, and Southport was just a drunken day out with the Loyalist marches, and you know. As a kid, I remember seeing them parading down the street, you know. So, you know, I'm no stranger through my upbringing to sectarian issues. You know, Liverpool experienced it, Glasgow experienced it. Obviously, nowhere near the same as in Northern Ireland, but we did experience it, and I personally experienced it, as I say. But having said all that, you know, when I saw the things, read, heard the things that Jim Fulton had said about killing a Catholic a week, I mean, it's just unbelievable, you know, unbelievable. Yeah, it's, there he is.
Yeah, and this is him here, Jim Fulton, who undercover officers got to know very, very well. 50,000 hours of covert recordings, and he didn't have a clue, Stephen, not a clue. In fact, you said in the book, and there's, I mean, I would advise everybody that they have to get the book. I don't want to go into too much detail because I don't want to spoil it, but there are some funny moments in it, because at one point he confided in one officer that he believed his neighbours were MI5 undercover officers sent to spy him, and he was actually telling an undercover cop.
Yeah, that's right. I think one of the other, again, not wanting to give out any spoilers, but I think the other, one of the other funny parts was where there was a police, was it a police helicopter or a plane that was up in the air, and Jim Poulton's in a lorry with an undercover officer, with an undercover officer driving, and he turns around to the undercover officer and he's saying, "Oh, don't worry about the police." He said, "I can smell them a mile off." And he sat next to one who's driving the lorry, you know, and then there's the, you know, the police aeroplane, he's up ahead, you know, as a spotter as well. I thought that was quite funny. But yeah, there are some humorous parts in the book on what is a very serious topic.
It had to have been a good thing that he was eventually behind bars, because quite obviously he was very dangerous, full of hatred, and had
without a shadow of a doubt. And I think the other issue there, Patricia, is that it was pretty obvious after 2 years that he wasn't going to say anything incriminating about Rosemary Nelson and that murder. And in fact, he denied any involvement at all, whether to undercover officers in the secret recordings, or whether it was when he was being recorded in his home by the secret probes that were hidden away in the house. You know, so it was pretty clear to Colin Port, who was running the whole show, the boss, that, you know, it was time to wrap up the Truman Show. You know, that's another euphemism I use in the book, calling, well, you've already mentioned it, Jim Carrey in the Truman Show. You know, so it was pretty clear to Colin Port that it was time to wrap up the Truman Show, because, you know, nothing else was going to be gained. And obviously the lawyers had obviously reviewed the evidence on the secret recordings and decided that there was enough material, enough evidence there, you know, for the Crown Prosecution Service to put it in front of a court, and basically it was certainly enough to arrest him. So arrested he was, and then flown off to Northern Ireland and processed in the usual way, and then ended up in Belfast Crown Court. And it's still I'm told it was the longest trial in Northern Ireland's legal history.
I have read that, I have indeed. Though I know he may not have admitted any involvement, but Stephen, did undercover officers hear anything that would have pointed to those who were involved?
In terms of Rosemary Nelson?
Yes, Rosemary Nelson.
Nothing, absolutely nothing. Something I discussed with Mark Dickens on a number of occasions, and it was pretty clear that there was nothing came out of the Operation George investigation that implicated Jim or Mark Swinger Poulton in the death of Rosemary Nelson. And bear in mind that Mark Swinger Poulton was also an invitee of the organized crime group in Plymouth, you know, the undercover team, because Swinger and Jimmy were in a Chinese restaurant one night in Plymouth when the whole conversation was recorded. But nothing at all. The only piece of material that I've ever been able to find is actually there in the public domain, and it's in the Rosemary Nelson public inquiry report, where the committee say that if the RUC had interpreted certain information a different way, in other words, it wasn't drug related, but it could well have been related to the bomb maker and connected to Mark Swinger Poulton, then it could have been interpreted in a completely different way. I mean, I have no shadow of a doubt at all in my own mind that from the intelligence that I've read that is in the public domain, that Mark Poulton in some way was involved in the bomb, the making of the bomb that killed Rosemary Nelson, and was probably involved or instrumental in the placing of that bomb under her car. I don't think there's any two ways about that.
And Mark Swinger Fulton passed away in prison around 2002. So
That's right. And we can only, it's like going back to what you said earlier, maybe one day there'll be some fresh piece of evidence comes up, crops up, that will result in a prosecution, successful prosecution of somebody for the, you know, for the shocking murder of Rosemary Nelson. I mean, all murders are shocking, but you know, I've got the greatest of sympathy for example, for the Lamb family, Adrian Lamb family. I've got the greatest of sympathy for them. But when you see the photographs of that silver BMW, what happened to her car when it was blown up, when the bomb detonated? And you can imagine what must have happened to that poor lady's body. Shocking, absolutely shocking. No, absolutely. Yeah, I'm almost without words to describe my feelings about that particular incident. Just terrible.
And the sad thing is, she was a human rights lawyer, you know? She was a human rights lawyer.
Yeah, she was, and she was doing a very good job. And, you know, the trouble is with people with intelligence, no matter what side of the divide, if you want to use that phrase, I don't like using that phrase, but people understand what I mean if I use that particular phrase. You know, I won't get philosophical about it, but there shouldn't be a divide. That's another argument. But you know, she was only doing her work, her job, for people on one side of the divide. There was nothing personal in it for her. She was highlighting things that were wrong, and things were very wrong. And the way she was treated by certain sections of the RUC at that particular time, you know, spat at, and some of the invective that was aimed at her was disgusting, absolutely disgusting. And you know, but again, going back to my own experiences in Liverpool when I was a young man, you know, some of the young officers that I worked with when I was still in uniform were from Belfast, and in fact some of them used to be B specials, so I was used to that type of hatred, that type of invective. You know, so, you know, that part of the story, you know, of the Troubles doesn't shock me per se, because I was used to that type of idiotic hatred and idiotic and senseless invective that was used on both sides of the divide, again, using that expression, because it's easier to use that than you know, explain at length that, you know, my own belief is there shouldn't be a divide. We're all living under the same roof, in the same land. You know, we're all human beings, and you know, I'm not preaching. I'm not going back to being a hippie and preaching love and peace. Well, I suppose I am in a way, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely, Stephen. No, you're bang on. So before we move on to the actual arrest of Fulton, let's talk about Muriel Gibson, because she was also of interest here and was also covertly recorded in this operation.
Yeah, she was. She was. And I think, I've got to be honest, I think that any normal person reading the facts about Operation George, reading all about Jim Fulton, reading all about Muriel Gibson, I think they would come to the same conclusion as I have, that Muriel Gibson was very lucky to get away so lightly. She was sentenced to 8 years in prison, and undoubtedly probably served four of those before automatic release. And when you read and understand some of the things that she said in these secretly recorded conversations, and her close involvement in the murder of Adrian Lemph, she got away very, very lightly. in my opinion.
From reading your book, it seems that Muriel Gibson has a lot that she could possibly divulge to bring a lot of people justice after losing people in their lives to...
She could. I mean, she describes the immediate aftermath of the Adrian Lamb killing. And it's quite clear to anybody, quite clear to me, and quite clear to anybody who reads that part, whether in my book or whether it's in the public domain, that there could have only been one shooter. And I say that in the book, there could have only been one shooter. And she knows who that was. And and in fact, unfortunately, you know, the laws of evidence dictate that unless she takes a witness stand and repeats what she said in the covertly secret recordings, if she repeats what she said about the shooter, then it becomes evidence, and that particular individual could have A, been indicted, and B, convicted of the murder of Adrian Lamb. Will that ever happen? Personally, I doubt it, unless Muriel Gibson has some kind of change of heart and changes into a person that thinks, I've got to do the right thing. Is that being too idealistic? I think it probably is, to be honest with you. But that's what it is. She could have remedied a lot of the things that were wrong.
Yeah. Stephen, did you come across, or did Mark come across during this undercover policing operation, any issues with protected state informants? Was there, I mean, because it's been heavily reported here, I mean, there's been two recent police ombudsman's reports that released about the use of police informers who were actually a part of paramilitary gangs killing people, and some of those informers did kill people while working for police. Was that an issue during Operation George, or was that, I mean, it didn't crop up because it was an English-led investigation?
I think it was something that the team themselves, the Plymouth-based team that were posing as the criminal gang, I think it was something that they came to suspect. They actually suspected that Jim Fulton could have been an informant for an RUC officer. In fact, at one stage, I'm right in saying that Colin Port was, this was addressed to Colin Port, and Colin Port said, no way, that's not true. But there were so many ramifications, that's not the right word. The RUC at that time was riddled with all kinds of shenanigans, political infighting, corrupt practices, etc., etc., etc. There's a lot of dodgy stuff going on. So, you know, whether Jim Fulton was in the pocket of certain RUC officers, I don't know. But I've got to be honest, from what I've read and what I've heard, it wouldn't surprise me. Nothing would surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
The state agent thing, it's something that I pursued at one time researching the book in relation to one particular individual. And unfortunately, when you, as I'm sure you've got your own experience of this, when you try and get information through FOI, Freedom of Information, you may as well bang your head against the brick wall. It's a total, utter waste of time.
Yeah.
Then I followed up another inquiry about a certain paramilitary, or he was a paramilitary at one time, who was supposed to have been arrested in a big drug deal in England £200,000 worth of drugs, probably ecstasy. And I made a FOI, Freedom of Information, request of the Crown Prosecution Service in London and in Gloucester, because I believe it could have been Gloucester where this guy was arrested. In other words, what I'm driving at, was this paramilitary or ex-paramilitary being protected? Is that why the £200,000 drug charge disappeared? The bottom line, Patricia, is I don't know, because I could never get to the bottom of it, and it's unfathomable. It really is. It's a black hole.
Yeah, it's a black hole. But Stephen, you the experience you have, I mean, not only in policing and legal terms, is that unusual not to be able to get that information?
Sadly, I have to say that it's not unusual. The FIO procedure started off. You know, the idea behind it is good. It's a good idea. And it started off being quite open to a degree, unless there were specific and valid reasons why information shouldn't be disclosed. But what's happened over the years, Patricia, and it links into the Mark Kennedys of the world and the undercover policing inquiry that is, in theory, still going on in London. And the Metropolitan Police, in my opinion, were responsible for this NCND business, neither confirm nor deny. Mm. You know, and that neither confirm nor deny, it's like the COVID-19 of freedom of information regime. It's what they all hide behind, neither confirm nor deny. You know, it's just so frustrating.
Yeah,
and it is a black hole. And
been there many a time, Stephen. I've received it lots of times. If I had a pound for every time I received it, I'd be very rich.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and you have investigative journalists that I admire greatly. People like Rob Evans of The Guardian. You know. And I'm sure people like Rob Evans would agree that when Freedom of Information first started off, that you could get hold of information to a degree. But I'm sure he will also agree with what I'm saying now, that now you can't. It's just an utter waste of time making a request in many, many, on many occasions. It's sad, but it's a fact.
So take us to the day that Jim Fulton was arrested. Where did that happen?
That happened in Plymouth. It happened at his home, and by that time he was living in a rented house near Whitley, in a district of Plymouth, and it had already been pre-arranged, the strike, as they call it in police parlance, already been pre-arranged. It was known the previous night that they were going to go around at dawn and arrest Jim Fulton at his home. And in fact, it was one of the last tasks that Robbie was asked to do, was move Jim Fulton's car, because Jim Fulton had been supplied with a Renault Laguna that was all kitted out with listening gear, unbeknown to Jim, of course, and he had to move it because the tactical team had seen that it was parked the wrong way around. I'm not a firearms expert or a firearms tactical expert, but apparently when they do these strikes, these arrests, and the firearms team are involved, they have to have the driver's door on a certain side. You know, it's like a safety factor or something. Well, it was parked the wrong way around, so Robbie had to go and ask Jim Fulton in the pub for the keys to the Laguna and move the car, which he did. And that was it. That was undercover officer Robbie's last night in Plymouth with all the other people. They disappeared. And the following morning, I'm guessing 5:30, 6 in the morning, whatever time it was, you know, I doubt very much the door would. There was a knock on the door. It was probably one of those ram things. They rammed the door in and arrested Jim at gunpoint, Fulton at gunpoint, and he was whisked off in a helicopter and taken to Belfast, which is unusual, as I'm sure you're aware. Normally, if somebody's arrested in England, they're taken to an English police station, but not him. He was flown straight off to Belfast.
In a military helicopter, yes.
You know, obviously for security reasons. So that was it.
And he cried like a baby over the Irish Sea, you say in your book?
He did. That's the information I have, that he started crying like a baby. One of the reasons was he thought that he was kind of being hijacked and he was going to be thrown out of the helicopter over the Irish Sea.
He was definitely paranoid, but not paranoid about the right people. And I'm sure Mark Dickens is very thankful about that. And as I said, I don't want to go into too much detail about the book. It's one of the best insights I've ever read into the taking down of a paramilitary terrorist. And it really is. And it's sad too that we don't get more books like this, but it is. And I advise everybody to go out and buy it. Mr. Fulton was told of the charges. He was told that, the gang that he was with was not a firm of gangsters. It was actually undercover police officers, and basically his face fell. And you have actually included in the book, Stephen, the entire trial, Mr. Fulton's trial, Muriel Gibson's trial. So, I mean, you've covered it from start to finish. And it's a great read. It really is.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Patricia. I must correct you on one thing.
Yes.
It's not the entire trial.
Is it not?
The entire trial would have taken another three volumes of books.
That's true.
I had to redact the trial material into something that was readable and manageable inside one book. So
a lot of work then.
It was a lot of work. And that probably, the material about the trial that is in the book probably represents about a third of the total material that is in the public domain. And if anybody gets the book, the public domain references are in that book. If anybody's interested enough to read the whole law report as to what happened, it's all in the book, all those references.
And he was charged with attempted murder. I think there was almost 50 charges. His victim included the murder of Elizabeth O'Neill, a grandmother who was killed in a pipe bomb attack on her Portadown home in County Armagh in 1999. And her murder was said to be fueled by sectarianism because she was a Protestant in a mixed family.
Yeah, that's another very, very sad case. 59-year-old grandmother, and she obviously instinctively grabbed hold of the pipe bomb which had been thrown into her home, and by instinct or whatever, she kind of grasped it close to her, and the thing blew up and that killed her, you know. So very, very sad. All murders are sad, as I said before, but you know, the particular circumstances of that, you know, it's but, you know, some of the stuff that he was charged with, even some of the stuff that he was acquitted of, it was like kind of Wild West, you know, where they got hold of AK-47 type automatic rifles and were spraying bullets at, you know, that prison officer's home. He was acquitted of that charge. But, you know, it's kind of like reading about the Wild West, or, you know, back in the Prohibition days of the United States, back in Chicago, you know, where you've got the gangs kind of shooting each other, spraying weapons all over the place. You know, it's unbelievable. But
listen, it's definitely a book to read. I'm just going to put it up here again so everybody can see. And Stephen, whilst I do that, you can tell everybody where they can buy your book, where it's available. So here we go, Operation George.
Yeah, it is, and it's the easiest place to find it is on Amazon. But if you want to buy it from a bookstore, then if you go to Amazon and you, if you want to buy the print version, go to Amazon, take a note of the 13-digit ISBN number, give that number to the bookstore owner, and he or she will order it in for you. So no problem. If you don't want to buy it on Amazon, you can buy it elsewhere. But in ebook format, it's only available on Kindle on Amazon. Thanks, Patricia.
No problem, Stephen. And listen, what are you doing at the moment? Are you working on any other books? You've had a few, not just Operation Julie and Operation George. You've had quite a few.
Yeah, I've written a lot of crime fiction in relation to the, as well as the non-fiction books of Operation Julie and Operation George. I'm actually writing, I don't know what it is, I seem to attract former undercover officers. I've got another undercover officer that wants me, I'm actually helping him write a series of fiction books at the moment about undercover cops, surprisingly enough. So I think the first book in that would, plan to make it a series, so I think the first book in that series will be out probably in a few months. Yeah.
You're busy. You're very busy.
I am busy. Yeah. I'm busy indeed.
So before we go, Stephen, where can people find you? Do you have a website? Are you on Twitter? Are you on Facebook?
Yeah, they can find me on my website, which is Stephen. Is my name up on screen? Will people see the spelling of my person? Okay. My website is Stephen Bentley, all joined up together, no gaps, .info. Facebook, just type in author Stephen Bentley. Twitter is at Stephen Bentley 8. Anything I've forgotten? I think that's it, really. That's the main things.
Brilliant, Stephen. Thank you. A great chat. Good luck with the new book and keep in touch.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.